Have you ever been to a family event and you've been sitting down on the ground with your child who's crying under the table, and a relative wonders out loud why you're not just being tougher? Maybe you're trying to explain ADHD to a teacher, or maybe your partner just thinks it's all screen time and doesn't even believe in ADHD. Enter A Child's Diagnosis, A Mum's Guide to Support and Helping Others Get It. Now, this guide is here to save you from those endless justifications and give you a break from being the ADHD explainer in every room that you enter. Here's what's inside. How to talk to professionals, because forgetting all of your points and remembering them in the shower later isn't really the vibe that you need in an appointment. How to handle skeptical relatives, being armed with responses that are factual, firm, and just the right amount of smile and nod. Support for your child, because navigating a world built for neurotypicals and Uncle Bob's back in the day speech really just doesn't help. And also practical strategies for school and home that work in real life. This guide isn't just about managing a diagnosis, it's about making sure your child feels seen, supported, and unconditionally loved, whilst you stay calm, or at least look like you're calm. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au. It's far less awkward than telling your mother-in-law to stop calling ADHD a phase. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Trigger warning on this episode: the content that we are going to listen to is going to be disturbing. It is going to be featuring child sex safety, child sex abuse. If you have any background or you could be triggered in any way, please click back out and click to a different episode. This is a trigger warning for anybody who is suffering from PTSD or anybody who would prefer not to listen to content on child sex safety. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have Christy McVie with us. How are you, Christy?
I'm great, thank you.
Now, I'm pretty confident that I have COVID.
We should come back off school holidays.
And I have less than 2 weeks before I have a fairly major surgery. So I've just got my voice back ready today. The reason I mentioned it is because I'm a little bit husky, but I feel okay and I want to push through because I'm so excited about this topic and I didn't want to reschedule till after the surgery. So, Christy, I am desperate to know, because I'm going to put in all of the show notes where to find your content online. My amazing 2IC, who is just, she makes me look good, I tell you. She found your content initially and emailed me and said, "You have got to get Christy. Can you check this out?" And I had a look and I watched all of the posts and it really has opened up my eyes to some things that I have had my head down, assuming it happened to other people. So I was wondering, what is your background that has led you up to doing what you do, and what is it that you do now?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Your 2IC is amazing for pointing me in your direction, because I have started following you as well and I think you do an amazing job, and I could have used you years ago with my daughter. But yeah, so I was a West Australian police officer for 10 years and I'd actually joined the police when my daughter was only 2 years old. I saw an ad in the local paper saying, "We want more female police officers," and she was 9 months old at the time, and I was like, yeah, I can do that. And I set on this journey to become a police officer, which is hilarious if you know me or if you ever get to meet me in person. I'm only 5'1". I'm really short, right? And everyone in my life was like, yeah, right. And I was like, watch me. So I became a police officer. She was 2 years old. And within the first week of becoming a police officer, going out on the road and after the academy, I had my first child abuse case where I was the first responder to a case. And that kind of, I think, set me on a bit of a path. Not only the fact that I was a parent with a young child, but the fact that I saw child sexual abuse straight away. And within a year, there was a call out for volunteers to go on special training to become a specialist child interviewer. And I put my hand up thinking, I want to do more. I want to help more in my community. I was in a smaller regional community at the time. And so I was chosen, and I'd only been in the job just like close to a year. I was chosen and I went on this 5-6 week training about child sexual abuse and becoming a specialist child interviewer. And for anyone who doesn't know what that is, a specialist child interviewer interviews children who have been sexually abused and abused and gets their evidence for court. And it's a special training because children are so vulnerable that they want to please adults and please people, and they need to be asked questions in a certain way. So as soon as I finished that training, I then went out into the community and I was interviewing children weekly, hundreds and hundreds of children over my time. And I did that for nearly 9 years. But after about 4 years in the police, I went, I don't want to hand those cases to the detectives anymore. I wanted to be the person who was, for want of a better way to explain this, locking up the bad guys as well. So I applied to become a detective, got into the detective training, and after 4 years, I was a detective investigating serious crime. I put my hand up to go into the child abuse squad and continued my career as a child abuse detective. I did do some normal detective work, investigation work, but then towards the end of my career, the last 2 years, I moved to another regional centre, actually because of my daughter. She has ADHD, as I kind of alluded at the start, and she struggled with friendships and friends. So I thought the best way to is to move to a smaller community. And so I moved to a community where I was interviewing children, investigating the cases, locking up the bad guys. And then I was also managing child sex offenders as they were released from prison after their sentencing. And that I did that for the last 2 years of my career. Now, as you can imagine, that left its toll. It wasn't actually investigating and helping the families and the children. It was actually the bureaucracy and the lack of actual action in regards to that. It really got me down towards the end. I had PTSD from what I was hearing and seeing for 10 years. And then also the fact that, you know, I didn't feel like I was actually helping kids in the end. It was pretty sad. So my daughter at the time, nearly 12, said to me, "Mom, I don't recognize you anymore. You're not the same mom I remember. I don't want you to do this job anymore." So the next day I went in and resigned and retired from the police 10 years and one day after I started. So that's a bit about my policing career. But yeah, it doesn't really, that was 5 years ago. I resigned. My last day was the 26th of January, 2020, just before COVID, funny enough. And then when I left and I was recovering, I just kept thinking, why don't people know what I know? Like, I kept saying things like, I heard the same stories by children. I heard the same stories by families. People didn't know what to watch out for, the red flags and warning signs. And it just was so frustrating for me. I just couldn't understand. And then I started writing things down. I was talking to mums of other kids and my daughter's friends' parents and stuff like that. And in the end, I wrote a book called Operation Kids Safe, A Detective's Guide to Child Abuse Prevention, and released that in August 2022. And from there, I realized that, hey, not everyone reads books. And so I started sharing those tips online. And here I am, 5 years ago to now, sharing all of the information I have and all of the things that I know online.
Wow. It's a massive, I've just a bit like blown away, to be honest. That's such an incredible background, and to go in it with such a small child. Wow. Anyway, little starstruck on that intro. So this podcast has really progressed over the last couple of years. So I'm not going to go into why a neurodivergent child will be more likely to be molested. I think we all know why. Obviously, lack of impulse control, social naivety, the people around them, it could be addiction in the family, surrounding influences are different, trauma. It can be quite rollercoastery to grow up in a neurodivergent family, which a lot of us have grown up in. So let's move on from that and say that we know that part. If we skip to grooming, now what I went right through your content because I got quite addicted, because it just highlighted to me how much I didn't know. So I would love to know, because I think people think they know. It's a little bit like executive function. People talk about executive function constantly. But when you say to them, what's executive function? They don't know. So let's talk about grooming. We think we know, but I don't think we do, because I learn a lot from your content. What would be your definition of grooming, and what does it typically look like? Because I think for a lot of us, we still have this old white man, asking someone to come and lick their ice cream, when it's actually not like that at all.
Yeah, totally. I guess the quickest and easiest way to describe grooming is preparing a child for abuse. And it's done in stages, dependent on the relationship between the child and the person that's grooming them. Now, quick few statistics to warm up the audience, for want of a better word, is that 90% of all child sexual abuse is done by a person known to the child, and nearly 50% of that will be a family member or a direct or indirect family member. 30 to 50% of all child sexual abuse is also done by another child. Now, that in itself is a really hard thing to comprehend, but what you would have learned in my content is 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys in Australia will be sexually abused before they reach 18 years old. And I've got one girl, and last year she had a friendship group. She's not in that friendship group anymore. And she was 1 of 5 girls in that group. And she was the only one who hadn't been sexually abused in that group. and dependent on the community that you're in, you know, the social economic status that you're in, all of the things, they all play a part. But what we need to know is, on average, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys will be sexually abused. And that's a statistic from last year. There was a research done. It's called the Australian Child Maltreatment Study. It's a really important study because it's given us up-to-date research on children. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of research to be done because we haven't broken it down into neurodivergence versus, you know, non-neurodivergent, etc. And here's the other thing. Like, they've worked out through that study that over 1 in 4 Australians, so 28.5% of Australians have been sexually abused before as a child. So 28.5%, nearly 1 in 3 adult Australians have been sexually abused. And in my experience, it was generational. You know, like, I would see a child who comes in and, you know, reporting abuse or giving a statement or being interviewed, the parent and the grandparents would be victims or had been victim survivors. So back to your original question, what does grooming look like? Well, grooming starts off, like I said, there's about 6 stages to grooming. The first stage is finding a victim. So the finding the victim stage could be someone in their own family, or it could be a coach or a teacher or whoever, you know, finding a child that is open to being groomed. Now, children who are being groomed don't know they're being groomed, right? So they're just excited. And I will keep referring back to the fact that children with neurodivergence, you know, like you said, executive function, social skills, etc., you know, so this person's going to isolate this child away from their social circles or from their safe parents or whoever, and they're going to love bomb them. Do you know what the word love bomb means?
Yes, because I did a episode recently on narcissists, and that was out there. But yes, re-explored, not bomb.
Yeah, so like, they'll love bomb a child into believing that they're, you know, they'll make them feel special, they'll give them gifts. You know, they'll just basically love bomb and make that child feel really special. And that's part of the grooming process. But in the same time, whilst they're love bombing the child, they're isolating the parents or the safe people from that child. So they're creating this environment where the child feels safe with that person. And the person is then saying, you can't trust your parents, or you can't trust your safe adult. I'm the only one who understands you. But they might be in the background, like a narcissist, bad mouthing that child to that safe adult, or, you know, creating this disconnect between the child and the adult so that the adult won't trust the child either. So there's a little bit of a game that they play with both adults and children in order to get the child prepared for abuse.
Okay, quick question. I'm a real questioner. I'm like fascinated like that. I think this is part of why I don't see this happening to my children, which is part of the reason why I'm probably more at risk, because I haven't had those conversations that I should have. Mm-hmm. But when I hear that, I think there's nobody that I know that would do that. Like, if we talk about, and I know that you can't, you know, use examples of what it would be, but like typically, like, what would be 3 examples of people that would do this? I just don't even fathom it.
The actual like type of person or the...
Yeah, like, is this, are we talking a gymnastics coach or like what?
Well, like, here's the thing. There was research last year that, and your listeners are going to be absolutely gobsmacked by this. It was an anonymous survey research that they did. So they couldn't identify anyone who was a participant. 1 in 6 adult Australian males identified that they were attracted to children and teens. And 1 in 10 said that if no one was to find out, that they would sexually abuse them. And they broke it down into age groups and age categories. So the way the research worked was that they would say, if no one was to ever find out, would you sexually abuse a child under the age of 14? Would you sexually abuse a child under the age of 13? Would you sexually abuse? So the research basically went down in age categories. So not all of them were attracted to little children, but some of them were attracted to prepubescent. Some of them were attracted to pubescent children. So, you know, and then a lot of people don't realize, and this was something I saw all the time, not all sex offenders, or child sex offenders, should I say, are attracted to children. Some of them offend purely because it's a control and power thing. So there's 3 categories. One is predatory, or I call them pedophilic. They are attracted to children. And 97% of those attracted to children are more likely to offend against boys. So, you know, your classic child sex offender that we think of, they're attracted to children, they're not attracted to adults, and they will more likely offend against boys. The next category is opportunistic. So they might be attracted to children of a certain age, but they're also attracted to adults. They can maintain a relationship with an adult and have a relationship with an adult, but then still abuse children. And that is a large category of sex offenders. The ones that I saw were usually parents, adults, you know, older relatives, etc. They're more likely to abuse a child. And then the last category is situational. So they might not have any attraction to a child, but they've got the opportunity to abuse a child. Or something's happened in their life at the time, like they've lost their job or their wife's left them or their partner's left them or whatever, and they're feeling a sense of lack of control. So then they will abuse a child in whatever reason, wherever their head's at. So that's just more, like a very brief explanation of who offends against children. And the thing is that the stranger danger messaging that we got as children, you know, the white van, don't take lollies off strangers, you know, watch out with this. That ad only ran for a total of 10 days in the 80s or early 90s. And so it's left a massive impact, and it's actually helped child sex offenders and abusers abuse children, because we think that they get taken off the street, but no, it's 90% of it. It's more likely to happen in your own home.
Well, that was a seriously disturbing response to the question.
Sorry, you might need to put a big content warning at the front of this.
That, I mean, I'm here for it. Like, I mean, I did want to cancel because I was like, I'm here for it, but I'm like actually more disturbed than I expected to be. Okay. Well, that was super fucked up. I'm sorry, guys.
I know. Well, and I'm not laughing at that. I'm laughing at the fact that I'm the type of person that gets invited to parties and everyone doesn't want to talk to me.
Oh, no, I'd be like, they'd be like, I can't wait to talk to her. And then 5 minutes in, I'd be like, oh, no, I'm
now. No, 40. No, I don't want to know anymore.
Yeah. Now it's become real. So, we know that neurodivergent children are probably going to be more, I would imagine, susceptible to, if they feel out of place and they're seeking that connection. And then you talked about love bombing. I can imagine for a child having all of that one-on-one time and love bombing would work pretty well, I would assume. So I was wondering what that would kind of make them more vulnerable. Are there some key things that predators look for that they then target particular children?
Yeah, and you've just hit the nail on the head. The reason why neurodivergent children are at bigger risk is because they tick a lot of boxes when it comes to being vulnerable. So some of the things that they'll look for is, and look, there's a lot of things, and a child can be groomed from any age, but they'll look for children who don't have a safe connection, or, you know, they're not safely connected to their families. So there might be struggles between parents and children. You know, separated parents are a massive target. So if there's any kind of separation there, or no safe attachment to any groups or any friendships, or they're struggling in their friendship groups, you know, LGBTQI plus kids are a big target. Children who are very young are a massive target. You know, over 50% of girls, unfortunately, their first sexual abuse is usually before 5 years old. So young children and children who are like struggling with connection, they're the children that are really easy to groom and to abuse. But that doesn't mean that we don't have ways to help protect them. And look, this part of the episode is probably all about the scary stuff and it's scaring parents. But let's put it this way. My daughter is neurodivergent. We didn't know that. But a lot of the things that would have made her vulnerable and susceptible because of my training. And it was funny, I said to someone the other day, you know, if I hadn't have become a police officer when she was 2 and I hadn't have learned about child sexual abuse in the way I did when she was 3 and I hadn't learned about grooming and what they do, it could have been a whole different story for my daughter, because we didn't know she was neurodivergent until 13. We should have, but we didn't look at it like that. But, you know, she had me in the background, you know, teaching her all this stuff from 2 and 3 years old. I started talking about body safety with her. So there is lots of ways that we can protect our kids. You know, that safe connection and attachment is really important. Children who have at least one safe person that they can share everything with, that's a way we can keep our kids safe. But yeah, it's interesting. They do definitely go after neurodivergent children. And in my experience investigating this stuff, I saw a lot of neurodivergent children as victim survivors. So it's not easy for us, but we have lots of tools in our tool belt. We can create awareness. We can create a lot of safety for our kids.
Okay. I reckon one of the biggest misconceptions, because this is where my brain goes when I hear you talk, which is why I think I've made not mistakes in the past, but I definitely am more aware now after following you for, you know, only a month. When you were talking about children not being connected, for me, I just go, well, I'm connected to my kids. that wouldn't happen to me. That seems to be one of the things that I think, which is obviously just want to live in oblivious land. But I was just wondering, would that be the biggest misconception, or are there others from parents that go, it wouldn't happen to my child, like it's not relevant to me, I don't have to talk to my kid?
Yeah, so most parents have this misconception that it doesn't happen in their homes, their communities or their places. And like I've just said, you know, 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 5 boys, 90% is by someone known to the child, 30 to 50% is another child doing it to your child. So the thing is that we have this misconception, we have this belief, and it's dangerous to have that belief. It's dangerous and it doesn't protect your kids. The other thing that's really interesting or really scary for me is that only 1 in 3 adults believe children when they tell them that they've been sexually abused. So in most parts, we don't believe our kids when they tell us as Australians. So this is a thing, like a connection is very important. And this is another study that I found out about. I've got a podcast and I had a criminologist on my podcast and she came in with this study and I was like, that's what I needed to know. And this will help all the parents listening. So they did a study of child sex offenders in Queensland in 2019. And they asked the sex offenders, once you'd groomed the child and were about to abuse them, what stopped it? If you didn't complete the abuse, what actually stopped you from abusing? Or what stopped the abuse?
Oh my God, that's an amazing question.
And this is the thing. I already knew this in my mind through just what I'd observed and what I saw. But we now have this study and 84% of them said the thing that stopped the abuse was the child's compliance. So they said no, or they fought, or they went and told an adult. The 16% that stopped the abuse from continuing was a protective parent. So your child needs to know this stuff because you can't be with them all the time. You can't protect them. You can't put them in a bubble as much as we want to. I mean, my daughter's nearly 17 and getting a license and she's doing things that I'm like, but I have to let her go. I'll have to, you know, and it doesn't matter if they're little or big, you have to let them try things. So the thing is that we have to give them the tools. We have to arm them ready to know. And then we can have age-appropriate conversations about this stuff. And it doesn't have to be scary. It doesn't even have to sound like you're talking about sex abuse, but we can arm them and empower them with that stuff. So that is probably the best advice I can give any parent, is that talk to your kids about this stuff and then be as protective as you can without, you know, hindering them. But here's something to teach your kids. One of the body safety conversations we have with our kids when we're teaching them body safety is about understanding their early warning signs, understanding what it feels like to feel unsafe. So when we talk about that, and when my daughter was really little, I used to ask her questions like, you know, if she was upset or she was telling me, I'll say, what is your body telling you? Or how does it feel in your body? You know, and I would explain to her, hey, when I feel unsafe, I'm feeling a bit unsafe at the moment. I have butterflies. My hands are sweaty. I've got a headache. I'm shaking. I used to explain it and get her to explain to me how her body felt. So when she had anxiety or anything, she'd say, my body feels sick. And I'd say, which part of your body? Oh, in my tummy. And I was able to understand from a very, and she was able to understand from a very young age how her body felt when she felt unsafe, anxious. And then the best thing about this is we can, because, you know, like I was just saying, sometimes we have to let our kids go and try stuff, right? So we've got unsafe and safe at either end, risking on purpose, fun to be scared. Some of our ADHD kids and kids with neurodivergence are going to be like, they're going to love that fun to be scared part, right? You know, going down a big slide, going on a roller coaster, all of that fun stuff. That's fun to be scared. And then the other one is risking on purpose. Speaking in public is risking on purpose for some people. Some of it feels really unsafe. Some of it feels safe. Like for me, I get a bit nervous, but hey, I'm okay on a stage and I can talk. You ask someone else, they think they're going to die before they get on a stage and talk to people in public. So the continuum is, you know, those four things: unsafe, risking on purpose, fun to be scared, safe. So how do we feel in those moments? And then we can help our young people, our kids, understand each stage. So when they feel unsafe and they get those early warning signs in their body, that gut feeling that we're very good at ignoring, but if we teach them to understand those really important feelings, and then they know, okay, when I feel this, I go and do this, and which is they should go and tell one of their safety network, one of their 5 safe people. And then that's how we teach our kids. And sadly, my daughter, we realized that she actually isn't able to identify pain. So sometimes she's in pain, but she can't feel it. Like My husband does. My husband has a very low pain threshold. I have a very high pain threshold. My daughter's like blitzes mine. So, you know, like it's similar to that in a way, in that we all feel things differently, but we just need to be able to put words to it. We need to be able to put a voice to it. And teaching young children that from a very young age is so important.
Yeah. And you know what really was making me think then was when you're talking about trusting your body, so, you know, that gut instinct, something's not right, I should leave, I should tell my mum, whatever it is. If we are unaware that our child is neurodivergent, and, you know, I think education now is really coming out a bit more, but it's still a place of privilege diagnosis because you've got to get in, you've got to pay the money, it's a whole thing. So that sucks to begin with. But if we are unaware that our child is neurodivergent, we may be telling them to ignore their body accidentally. Like, what do you mean your shoes don't fit? They seem fine. Everyone else is wearing that jumper. What do you mean? There's nothing wrong with that food. Eat it. And I do wonder with that, some of those things, because then they're being told that what they feel is then not true.
Or not valid.
So then what you're saying is that they need to be taught to trust their body. But I wonder in some of those situations where we just want to get out the door, we don't know the neurodivergent, we don't know there's a sensory issue. We're like, what do you mean? Brush your teeth, get in the car. Why is it so hard? What do you mean the toothbrush feels funny? Don't worry about it. I suppose then we would have those children that wouldn't say no necessarily, or would then become uncompliant in those situations from what you've said, because we've been teaching them to ignore their body.
Yeah. And look, I didn't know my daughter was neurodivergent for a long time, but I was teaching her body safety the whole time. So this is the thing. And don't get me wrong. You know, it's not a one and done situation. It's not a one and done conversation. Sometimes I've had to tell her, hey, we've got to go. Let's go. Even though she's absolutely anxious for what's coming next or whatever. But, you know, when I've had a moment, I would talk to her about it. Hey, you know, I didn't listen when I should have. I'm sorry. It's really important to listen to our bodies. Like I repaired that afterwards. So don't feel bad if you're thinking through situations and you're like, I didn't listen and I didn't trust and I didn't hear my child, because some situations are really hard to do. But the main thing is we reinforce and repair later. Yeah. So I just think body safety conversations is the number one thing any parent can teach their child. Anything. It's bigger than, you know, we teach our children how to cross roads. We teach them, you know, how to swim. We teach them how to put a seatbelt on in the car. We need to add these lessons to that.
I am very excited to hear about body safety, but we are going to do that in the next episode on practical strategies. Can I direct us back to grooming? Are there specific phrases or patterns of behavior that a child might exhibit if they are being groomed? What would we be looking for if you were wondering if it's happening?
Yeah, so... sadly, what we see is massive changes in behavior, and it can be good and bad. So when I say massive changes in behavior, if you've got a child who is very disorganized, very disruptive, very angry, very upset, you can see a massive flip into the positive, and we can think, oh my gosh, they're listening, they're not going out anymore, they're not doing this, they're not doing that. And the reason for that is that a child who doesn't feel control or is being controlled by someone else will then try and control their environment. Or that what they can control. So that you might see a child who was predominantly not listening in class becoming a straight A student. So that can happen, or it can be the other way. A child who's always sort of gone along with the flow, has been easy to deal with, becomes really hard to deal with, is really pushing back, is really upset all the time. And a lot of the times these groomers, abusers will tell the children, if you tell anyone, no one will believe you, you'll get locked up. And I've had cases where they've been threatened that they're going to kill their parents, their pets, their brothers and sisters, you know. And like I said, these people are generally someone in the family or someone who's close to the family. And then that person's also saying things like, no one will believe you. No one will love you anymore. If you tell anyone, I'm going to get put in jail. Your mum or dad will leave me, or whatever they can use. So part of that grooming process is, you know, finding a vulnerable child, getting the child alone, abusing them, but they're also manipulating them to keep the secret. Behavior is a form of language. So when our children change behaviors suddenly, or like there's a massive flip, and sadly, our ADHD kids and our neurodivergent kids, that's their normal. So it can be really hard to see. We see children who, especially younger children, but even teenagers who might start bedwetting again, We see children who are having UTIs, like physical reactions, that all of a sudden they don't want to spend time with certain family members or people. They don't want to go to a sport or a group that they were really interested in. They're getting messages from someone, and we'll go more into that next episode about some of the tools that they use. So this is why it's really important to have really safe attachments with our kids where we can have conversations. Also for them to know that it's never their fault if someone is doing this. So one of the statements I say to my daughter all the time and have said all the time is, no matter what happens, I'll always love you. You are not the behavior. And breaking up behavior from who she is as a person, an individual, we might behave a certain way, but we're not that person. You're a good person. You've got a good heart. You know, you're considerate. You're this. So when she is acting out or she is being angry and stuff like that, she is not that. She is not that behavior. And by saying that, I'm like, no matter what you do in your life or what you say, I will always love you. And you can come to me about everything and anything. So, you know, the main two priorities in body safety is they have the right to feel safe at any time, at all times. Everyone has the right to feel safe. And the second one is you can speak with someone about anything. So one of those five people or just anyone. So you have the right to feel safe and you come to me with anything. And that's how we reiterate and keep telling our kids.
Wow. Okay. I love this. I'm just like, I feel like I'm about to ADHD hyperfocus right down into, which should, I definitely don't think would be great for our mental health at this point. But anyway, last question, Christy. What should parents do if they suspect that their child is being groomed? What would be a step to take? And what would be some mistakes that you've seen parents do that we should not do?
Yeah. So I guess for me personally, like I think of it from a parenting perspective and I think of it from a policing perspective. You know, parents can freak out when they think that something's going on or they've got evidence of something going on. So it's really important that we remain calm. Again, if you suspect it, the best thing to do is to try and get your child to tell you. If they're not telling you, it's because they're scared. And children will only disclose abuse if they feel safe. And so the most important, before we even get into them telling us what's happened and how we respond, is that they need to feel safe. So how can you make your child feel safe? That could be getting them separate from where you think that that abuse is happening, if it's someone in the family or someone that they know. It could be creating like their favorite safe environment. My daughter, when she's not feeling safe, she's like burrowing into her bed with like a movie on. And one of the things I learned early on is kids don't like you to like be right in their face and in their eyes. So sit next to them or lay next to them and play their game or play whatever they're doing and just be there with them and just be gentle with it. Don't go, well, you know, like don't lose it at them. Give them a safe space. Be that safe person, because the experience of I've had is kids will protect their parents if they're scared for their parents, you know, especially if we've ever said something like, if anyone ever touches you, I'm going to kill them. Or if you ever do this, I'm going to do this to someone. Or if we've ever overreacted over even the smallest of the things. And kids will test us with the small stuff to see how we'll react with the big stuff. So our child might be trying to tell us what's happening and they will test us to see how we will react with the little things before they even tell us the big thing. So how we react matters. So learn how to just take a deep breath. I mean, I'll leave you with one little story. My daughter at 10 came across porn and she came and told me, right? We'd had conversations before that about porn. I had been having conversations with her about inappropriate content since she was 3, 4. And so, and in age appropriate ways for anyone who's going, what? Anyway, so, and then she came to me and she said, Mom, I need you to sit down. My head went exactly straight to, oh my gosh, she's been sexually abused, but it wasn't. It was, she had been Googling sex and porn came up and she saw porn for the first time. And I had to go, excuse me, I just need to go to the toilet. I'll just be a minute. I'm not mad at you. That's how it went. But in the toilet, I was like head in hands, like screaming inside going, you know, like I had to control my emotions and I had to control my reaction, because if she'd seen that, she wouldn't want to tell me the rest. So my advice to you is take a deep breath if it's something that's really scary and get yourself ready mentally to hear what they have to say. And if that means going to the toilet, go to the toilet.
I know I said it was only the two more questions, but I just got one more real quick follow-up. Is when you were talking before, you said about how they might test us with the smaller stuff.
do you mean that they might like throw out a small comment that could be related to the individual and then test us to see whether we believe them, or is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, in many ways, like that's one way they might test us with something small like, oh, what would you do if this happened? Or it just depends on the child and how they are trying to process everything. You know, my daughter would say, what would you do if, you know, you've caught me smoking? Or what would you do if? And so I knew something was going on in the background. It triggered things for me going, oh, what's she trying to work out here? Before she wanted to see how I was going to react with some of this stuff. Like, and again, she hasn't been a victim of child sexual abuse that I know of. And, you know, me being a detective and a police officer probably put up barriers that she wasn't willing to talk about some stuff in her childhood, but it comes out in the wash. The main thing is that your child needs to know that you're going to be a safe person. And if you do overreact with small stuff, go and repair that and say, hey, I wish I hadn't have said that. Like, that didn't work out. I'm trying to be the calm parent in this family, but, you know, I'm losing it. I didn't mean to, you know, just know that I'm trying really hard and I'll try next time. I think, you know, we're humans as well, right? And there's no guidebook for parenting. So I hope that that's given you, like your parents, the people listening, some tools, because we just need to try our best and our best will be enough.
Wow. Well, that was a powerful statement. Let's finish up on that. Thank you so much for your time, Christy. I feel a little disturbed, which I was expecting to feel disturbed by the prevalence and some of the statistics that you talked about. But thank you so much for your time. Next week, we are going to be exploring practical strategies. So we are going to get into body safety, what to do. I wanted to break it into two episodes because sometimes people think they're going to come back. They don't actually come back, but we want everybody to be really aware of what the practical strategies are. And I don't want that to be missed because it's in the second half. So that will be released next week, and we are going to go into that then. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.